Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Cut and Splice. This is Jason.
And I'm Matt.
And this is Gil.
And tonight we are talking about the 2016 film Free Fire. It's a movie directed by a guy named Ben Wheatley. And I think it's a pretty interesting film. And I was the one who suggested this movie, and I'm extremely curious to hear what the other guys thought about it.
One thing that happened to me is, as I was watching it, is I had one of those moments of, wait, is that the movie that was such and such and such? And then I was like, yeah, this is what this is.
That you were slightly aware of its existence?
Yeah, because when it came out, there was this talk about a movie where everything happens like in a warehouse. It was like the shtick of the movie, and it got so reviews, so I didn't end up like seeing it. Most of the time, I don't see these movies; I just can't get around to it. But I thought, that's interesting. I wonder how well or not so well they did it, because those are very tough to pull off.
I can think of a few that definitely didn't work out so well.
Yeah, so it's like having this moment like 20 minutes into the movie. They're just going to stay here the entire movie. So you kind of like strap in. I don't know, Matt, were you aware of it when you were?
I had seen trailers. I don't remember precisely why I didn't go see it in theaters. I don't know, it just kind of flew under the radar for me. I don't know why I just broke on that word right there, but I don't know, it just didn't get me off my ass at the time. Maybe it was because of the Trump election. I don't know. Maybe. Blame it on Trump. I don't know. Maybe there was just too much shit going on in my life at the time. But it was... I did finally just watch it this last week. So, this is going to be a first impressions thing for me.
I saw that the director, he directed Meg 2, which is in theaters.
I actually just saw that tonight. I didn't see the movie tonight. When I glanced at his IMDb page, I was like, oh, wow, that's a reason that I might actually seek that out and see that.
Yeah. And also, he did another movie that you mentioned, Jason, to possibly do in the future, Kill List or something?
I don't know if I recommended that or not, but that did jump out at me. I've heard of that movie before, but I've never seen it.
Oh, you've never seen it, so never mind.
You might be conflating it with something else, but...
Killer Elite. Maybe I'm confusing it.
Yeah, perhaps it might be that one. But no, I was listening to some of the stuff this guy was saying, the director, and he was... I think that's a movie that he did that gained some acclaim or something like that in particular. It made me kind of want to possibly seek it out.
Yeah. Cool.
I have never seen any of his other films, so I don't know how this compares to any of them.
And what is it about this movie specifically that you thought would worth discussing? Like,
well, a few things. For one thing, we were talking about maybe 6 months ago or something like that. Well, I would say all the time whenever we're talking about this podcast and trying to figure out what to watch and batting ideas around, we're always talking about trying to do some stuff that's different. And I don't know. I'm not sure exactly what specifically made this come to mind, but I know that years ago when this movie came out, I remember... I don't remember if I saw it with my friend Steven or if I just saw it at the exact same, like the opening week when it came out, and he also saw it or something like that. But I just know that we discussed the film in depth when it came out, and we both liked it a lot, particularly because of the fact that it's funny that Matt mentioned politics because it was 2016. I wonder if that might have had something to do with it. I don't know. But I just know that both of us saw this movie, possibly together, possibly not. I don't remember. And felt that it was a huge breath of fresh air because it's a movie that I just remember 2016, you know, there was a lot of there's a lot of people talking about 2016 as being like one of the worst years of all time. And I didn't have a particularly terrible year in 2016, but I remember, you know, like there was a lot going on, and in particularly in regards to movies, both of us just had this feeling that we were just, it was just a lot of Oscar bait and a lot of, you know, bad films and stuff like that at the time. And this movie came out and we just thought it was so great that somebody made a movie that is so not pretentious in any way whatsoever. And it's so very aware of what it is. And yet at the same time, it's, I mean, in case anybody didn't know, this isn't much of a spoiler, but there's a lot of action in the movie, but it's all very grounded. And, you know, the interplay between the characters is very much about the characters and things. It's not a gigantic movie. It's very small in scope, but it's that what's going on is of dire importance to each character. And so, you know, it just, it was so different in that sense, even though it was so grounded and so such an easy elevator pitch basically. But both of us really liked it. And I just thought to myself, you know, this would be a movie that I'm sure we're going to have a decent amount of disagreement about, but hopefully you guys didn't hate, and hopefully we, you know, at least got some enjoyment out of while watching, and then would make an interesting episode because we can talk about it and talk about what makes it so different and stuff like that.
Yeah, this was hot garbage. No, I'm joking.
I wouldn't be completely surprised if you might go in that direction, but no, I mean, there's definitely some redeeming qualities to it.
it's a fine movie. It's a movie that's there to
exist.
Yeah, exist and do a job, and it does the job. And it's a little odd. I think when I originally started watching it, or when I originally went through Amazon, it was labeling it as a bit of like an action comedy or something like that, and I think that it's kind of too violent and too it's like the perfect amount of violence that it can't be comedic.
Like, it has comedic elements,
right, but I mean that when it actually elevates to the point of, you know, trying to list it as a bit of a comedy, I mean, the violence either has to be like Cabin in the Woods, third act, like this is just ridiculous kind of violence, or it has to be less violent than this movie. The violence of this movie is actually pretty freaking real.
Yeah, a bit too much at times.
Right, so... I think that's the biggest area where the movie missed the mark was in terms of, I mean, if it was trying to hit a certain chord of levity, in terms of this action sequence and, you know, like make you chuckle from time to time, the violence was actually too realistic. It was actually exactly at the wrong place to be comedic.
I laughed out loud in the theater and at home this time. This was only the second time I've ever seen it.
I guess if it's like spoiler related, you should tell us like which points those are, because that would be interesting. I do think that to piggyback on what Matt said, it's two things. I thought of the way of the gun, because of, you know, the whole theme of like all these bad people kind of deserve each other, and like, you know, nobody can trust anybody. That's a common theme in most like crime movies, and then the violence, like that, like there are some points in Way of the Gun that I mentioned that is like, that was just not necessary. Like they just really didn't have to go there. Like the, when he jumps into the glass and the fountain. So there are similar things here where I was like, I don't think I needed that. Like, I think this movie would have been just fine without it. And a good comparison for this movie to maybe we could bring up a few times throughout the discussion is Tarantino, like the obvious one being Reservoir Dogs, where the majority of the movie is in a warehouse. And that's probably the best warehouse movie of all time that I can think of. And that is humorous. And the way Tarantino does violence, there is something very humorous. He got even more humorous as he progressed, like after Pulp Fiction, definitely Inglourious Basterds, like Django. He went very over the top, Kill Bill too, like with the violence to the point of humor, like that it's just comedic, which I'm not a big fan of actually. But in spite of that, like I do think that he finds a way to make Reservoir Dogs have a better balance of humor and violence. The violence is not funny, but the dialogue and the characters are funny. So I don't know. It's but I think that's the biggest flaw of this movie, is that it's like how we often say about like a decent sci-fi movie or like an action movie, and we say like, well, if only like Denis or like Nolan directed this, it would be like a great movie. But because it wasn't, because they can't direct every movie that's made, it's like subpar. So I feel like this movie suffers from the same thing. Like if Tarantino made this, it would be a great movie, but because it's not, and it's not even close to the quality of dialogue that he has, it barely keeps your attention in spite of all the shooting and explosions and, you know, dramatic scenery and lighting. So that's like my overall impression of it. And so I would probably, if I had to rate it, I would probably give it like a 4 or a 5. Like I think more than anything, I appreciated the cast and the acting, but the dialogue, the storyline, a lot of it just was very, very messy. Like I just really, and we can get into some of the details, but it was just, some of it didn't almost make any sense, but I get it. It was a premise for the sake of having this movie, and I'm sure it's enjoyable to many people to watch it. And
I think I liked it more than Gil, but I mean, you got to give the movie a certain amount of props for, well, using props the way that it did.
Almost all the effects are almost all real in it. It's like very,
I like a thing in it.
Hmm?
Was that like a thing that they did? Like a lot of the.
I don't know. I mean, I was just trying, I was trying to find out how long it took them to shoot the movie. And in the process of doing so, I found a few trivial tidbits and stuff like that. And I mean, it was just saying that like, there was a few scenes where the characters are driving in the car at the beginning, where they just used a green screen in the background just because it was cheaper to, you know, composite the city in behind them kind of thing. But aside from that, like pretty much everything in the warehouse is like squibs and, you know, the traditional, things that they use for, you know, for gunplay type scenes and stuff like that. I mean, a lot of makeup and things, and, you know, it wasn't, there wasn't a lot of special effects in that sense, like computer special effects or anything like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if anything, it's proof that you can use real guns and all that stuff and not pull an Alec Baldwin.
There was a whole thing in the special features, actually. There was not a whole thing
about Alec Baldwin.
No. In the making of thing that I glanced at, they had a whole thing where they took a moment to show the armor and the special effects guy, and then like kind of like talk about all the preparation they did and stuff like that.
Yeah. I mean, that's admirable. And, you know, I mean, I think a lot of the choreography was pretty strong. I mean, eventually the movie turns into just one big shootout with, you know, a few breaks in between and everything for some dialogue. But, you know, I think they did a pretty good job of establishing the geography of the warehouse and showing where everybody is at any given time, and having the sequence play out the way that it plays out, and characters generally acting the way that their personalities would
dictate.
So I mean it's strong there. I also appreciate that Sam Riley had a pretty big role in this. I mean, the only other movie that I really know him from is Control, and he was really good in that movie, and played an entirely, well, maybe not entirely.
Actually, pretty damn different.
Yeah, pretty entirely different character in this movie. Because in Control, he was playing like the one major rock artist who died at the age of 22 who wasn't on drugs. I think this like lands at like a 6.5 or a 7. It's just one of those movies where, like, you know, I love Cillian Murphy. I love the fact that this was Brie Larson before she went insane. I mean, Noah Taylor is one of those actors who always seems to fall under the radar, and he seems to fall under the radar for the same reason that Gary Oldman fell under the radar for like 30 years, because he's just so good that you barely even remember who he is or what he's doing. I just think that it's one of those movies that it would be an odd situation where a conversation would come up and I would say, like, hey, we should watch this movie. Yeah, like, this is a really good movie that I think that we should delve into, which is really entertaining and is kind of an exemplar of, you know, whatever we're talking about. It's just one of those middle of the ground movies that, you know, I don't regret spending 90 minutes watching it, but I don't see myself spending another 90 minutes watching it again.
It's interesting you say that, because when I saw this movie, I kind of touched on this already, but when I saw it in theaters, I loved it. And then when it came out on Blu-ray, I waited till the price dropped to something reasonable, probably like $10 or something like that. And I scooped it up as quickly as I could. And oddly enough, it sat on my shelf full of movies until a few days ago when I watched it for this. There have been at least a couple of times where I've suggested it to some people who had never seen it before, in the hopes of watching it and getting to vicariously feed off of their first viewing experience, which is something I do often with movies. But in the, let's just call it, let's say I got it sometime in 2017 or something like that. So in 5 years that it's sat on my, on my shelf, I've never once watched it, even though I had a very high opinion of it. And I do think it's a movie that has some rewatch value because there's so much going on. So it's one of those movies where once you know what's coming, you can focus more on the details, a lot like, say, you know, Black Hawk Down or something like that. But or Can't Hardly Wait. It's very interesting because, you know, like I said, or like you were just kind of mentioning, it didn't call out to me to watch it. You know, it's in a weird way. It's I think it's a strange movie for me because I really, really like it, but it's oddly forgettable in that sense, despite that feeling. I'd put it at about an 8. It's a very obvious comparison, like Gil said, to Reservoir Dogs. If I was to elevator pitch this to somebody, essentially it's, you know, it's Reservoir Dogs where there's a big giant shootout in the warehouse rather than a bunch of people going through a bunch of mystery of what the heck just happened in so on and so forth. So it's a lot more violent in that sense, and action-packed and such. But it's I don't believe that, and we can go into this in more detail, of course, but I don't believe that this movie was ever trying to be Reservoir Dogs. It's definitely not as good as Reservoir Dogs. And it's funny. I don't know. All I would say about it up front is simply that I think that the director did a really good job directing the movie. I think to kind of piggyback on what Gil kind of touched on earlier, it's like, I don't think that this movie would have been better directed by Tarantino. I just think that I think the writing's just fine. It's not like, doesn't blow me away or anything like that. It's very serviceable for what the movie's trying to do. I just think that this is a movie that is accomplished what it was trying to do very well, but what it was trying to do, it was not super ambitious. You don't walk out of this movie with a feeling of some incredible catharsis that you do with with movies like Christopher Nolan's films and Tarantino's movies and stuff like that. But I don't think it was ever trying to reach that level anyway.
Yeah. It's interesting. The critics like were fairly kind with it. Like it got like 6.3 Metascore, and actually it's got 6.3 from the audience, like IMDb rating. So I would actually expect it to be lower. So I guess there is something to it.
It didn't make any money according to IMDb,
which is surprising. Yeah. Because it's like a shoot 'em up movie with like some, it's a very strong cast. Like, I think if I'm not mistaken, Armie Hammer was probably coming off of like Social Network, and,
he was just blowing up this year because this is the same year as Man from U.N.C.L.E. I don't know if this was before or after, but yeah, he already had that Social Network fame. And
and Charlotta Copley also, I think around that time was doing a few movies with what's his name? Neil Blomkamp or whatever, the guy from District 9.
He was the how do you say his name?
Charlotta Copley
was, in my head, was that District 9 guy who was in this was that that one with Matt Damon?
Yeah, dude, it's the same director. The
Is it the same director?
Yeah. What's it called? Like this. Elysium.
Elysium. That's the one. Yeah. Great premise for a movie ruined by the last 30 seconds of the film. but yeah, anyway. Did we want to move right into the spoiler stuff?
I also just really quickly, I mean, obviously Brie Larson was just coming off of Room.
After Room?
Yeah, it was right after Room.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, point, Brie Larson, pretty much for me, the only thing she's done that I felt had any value was Room.
Yeah.
What?
And it's got nothing to do with, like,
Scott Pilgrim? Or anything.
That's true. She was decent in it. What was she in Don John?
She's the younger sister.
Younger sister? She's always like a sister. Like,
she has the really awesome. She brings the whole like point of the movie home at the end.
But let's just say that she's very replaceable in those roles. I don't think she left her mark. In Room, she was the movie, basically her and the kid. So obviously,
I defend her from time to time, except for the bullshit that she's said off camera. But oddly, that's like her biggest role and her most successful movie, and I've just still never seen it.
She's kind of like a less charismatic, not as good of an actor, Amy Adams type of thing. You know,
that's probably fair.
Like she's not the drop dead gorgeous type, but she's attractive. So she can fit in a lot of like different roles. She could have sex appeal, but she could also be like a, you know, tomboyish type of thing. But you can't see her doing nearly as decent as a job as Amy Adams did as like Lois Lane or, you know, some like of these characters. Cause she doesn't I haven't seen the Captain Marvel thing. I don't think I've seen any of those movies. So I don't know if she did better there.
Amy Adams. But Amy Adams, by no fault of her own, is a terrible Lois Lane.
She wasn't great, exactly. But it would have been even worse, is what I'm saying, with Brie Larson.
Oh, that would have just been also bad casting, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. No, I definitely think that what happened with like Amy Adams is they kind of felt like, well, she's a tough cookie, so it's just going to like work out. I think Zack Snyder, much like George Lucas, is like kind of like things like if just cast the right people, but don't actually give them good stuff to like build a character. It'll still work. It's on the page, but no, it's not, dude. You got to direct.
I think there's a lot of evidence that Zack Snyder was intentionally trying to be controversial with those movies.
Yeah, yeah, I can definitely see that. He's kind of like a fuck you guy type of thing. Like he was just trying
The opening scene of Batman v Superman is him taking Jimmy Olsen, the character that like everybody, you know, is reading comics as kids associated themselves with and like saw that through the eyes of and idolized Superman and everything. And they put a gun to his head and shot him in the face in the opening scene. And just like, this is not your old Superman, you know, come on. It was like a middle finger to the fans. I mean,
yeah. I mean, right. The only thing with those movies that really could not be denied, and maybe Zack Snyder made a mistake by casting him, is how good of a Superman, Henry Cavill was. Like, because he was a perfect Superman, and if he had
in spite of the terrible script and horrible,
and I know we've had this discussion, and I like Man of Steel more than you. But I definitely think he deserved a better Superman movie, and he could have easily made one with the right script.
He's so good in everything that he's in. I don't know if I've seen a role with him that was like bad.
Yeah, but anywho, so you're gonna say something, Matt?
Just imagine having $300 million to just give a middle finger to your audience. Oof.
I think he just makes his own movies and he hopes that people like it. And he tries too hard to not be
He's like a mini me to Kathleen Kennedy. I think it's two different things,
but
right. But Kathleen Kennedy has like what $10 billion to give a middle finger to her fans. I mean, like, I mean, that's all she does is flip us off all the time. So yeah, yes, Zack Snyder is a better person than she is. I don't know, and he's probably more talented. But you know, Kathleen Kennedy is definitely the better capitalist. But anyway, that was a rant that I was not expecting to go on. But
you know, I feel the same way. I was like, how did I get talking about Superman? This is horrible. Right. Not what I wanted to be doing right now. It happens. It's all good. Gosh, I'm just looking at his thing right now. Did Charlto, District 9 basically made him an actor?
Yeah,
he was uncredited in a short film and uncredited in another short film, and then he did that.
Yeah,
that's crazy. And then after that, another short film. Like, and then from there, immediately after District 9, the next year he does the A-Team, where he plays Murdoch. And then a few other things, Elysium. Oh, then a terrible video game that we don't need to talk about. Then I think the American version of Old Boy. Mm. Pretty sure 2013. That's probably the American version. And then he's in that stupid Maleficent movie.
The short films were with the same guy, like with
I assumed it was the short
that District 9 was based on, Alive in Joburg.
Yellow
is also him.
Yeah.
I don't know, maybe they were like friends in the neighborhood. Oh,
probably, or school or something.
Neil Blomkamp, if I'm not mistaken, was a special effects guy. And then he kind of used his talents to make these fancy short films that had special effects in them. And then he kind of sold himself off and say, like, listen, I know special effects, so I can make like a science fiction movie for really, really cheap. And that's how he got to make District 9.
Which was really good.
Yeah, like, it's crazy how, well, I think it's like a $5 million movie or something. It's like ridiculous.
No way. That's like, got to be like, on the top 20 list of like most successful movies then.
Yeah, I'm trying. No, actually, let me see. Offered him $30 million to do whatever he did, blah, blah, blah. No, I'm trying to find the budget, but yeah, I remember. $30 million. It's still pretty low. It's a huge, like, heavy special effect movie.
Yeah, well, it's a heavy special effect movie made in 2009. I mean, like a sci-fi movie at that time would have like an $80 million budget, or maybe even, you know,
100. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, $80 million if it's like not a high priority for the studio.
Yeah, no, but
of course that's back when those kind of movies were still being made.
Yeah, but unfortunately he was one of those directors that kind of burned too hot and like didn't really make a second good movie at any point with all his attempts.
I didn't even know he made Elysium. I mean, that I think that, like, I don't want to, you know, harp on it, but I mean, I think that's a great movie up until the last minute.
It's okay. It's got issues, and also you made Chappie, yeah, which is not great. Yeah, I didn't see Chappie, but I heard it was pretty good, pretty bad.
He's got a movie out now, Gran Turismo.
Yeah, but that's like
I've heard that's a car movie.
Pretty
good. It's not just a car movie; it's a video game car movie.
Yeah.
Actually, that movie was supposed to take over for Oppenheimer back on the. back in mid-August, so I don't know what it did with other auditoriums, but obviously ours is still going until next year.
I had
week,
a so. Co-worker tell me it was a really good movie.
Hmm.
I'm gonna check it out this week.
He seems to like to make shorts. He's been making shorts all along. That's interesting.
Yeah, it is interesting.
Digimon Hunso is in it. I haven't seen him in a while.
He also, I think, is going to be in the Zack Snyder Rebel Moon thing.
Okay.
Interesting trailer for that one.
Yeah. All right. Cool.
So back to going to spoilers? Or?
Yeah, sure.
Gil, did you ever give your like actual
It was like 4 or 5. I would say like a 5.
Oh yeah, you did. Okay. Yeah, I'm just making sure. Okay, cool.
Jason, I am curious, which parts did you find funnier than others? Or at least laughed out loud during.
I mean, I'm kind of surprised that I even have to say them. They're so funny.
Curious. I barely remember any detail of this movie, and I just saw it.
Well, for one thing, the obvious one is the Charlton Copley. I mean, he's just hilarious. His character is so vain, and he's so ridiculous. You know, I mean, and he's so believably ridiculous. He thinks he's so much smarter than he is. He thinks he's so much more respected than he is. Everyone, especially Brie Larson, are like rolling their eyes every time they're next to him and he says anything and they're not looking, and he's not looking at them. You know, I mean, he's so funny throughout the movie, and he's causing so much of the trouble. That's, you know, he's not the main cause, certainly, but he's so funny. I mean, 2/3 of the way through the movie, he's been shot at least once, maybe twice. And it's probably worth mentioning that every single character in this movie gets shot. Like, or killed. You know, I mean, there isn't anybody who comes out unscathed. But this guy, he's been shot at least once. Everybody at this point is crawling. And either out of necessity or out of trying to avoid getting shot. And he takes about probably 2 to 3 minutes to get a bunch of tape and tape a bunch of cardboard to his arms and legs and knees and make it. And so, cause he's planning to crawl out of the place. And at one point when what's that awesome guy's Jack Rayner, when he makes fun of him for it, he has some stupid line about how when he had special forces training at one point that they taught that because he in his own twisted mind, he thinks that he stands more of a chance of dying from infection by getting his arms cut or something like that as he's crawling through this crappy warehouse than he does of getting shot, you know, or something like that. It's the kind of thing that a complete idiot who thinks so highly of himself would say. It's so funny. And, you know, I mean, aside from him, I was listening to the first 5 minutes or so of the audio commentary, hoping that they would talk about how long it took them to film the thing. And it's kind of funny, Gil, you mentioned how you felt that the violence was a little too violent or something like that, whatever you were saying. The director was saying that the first draft of the script was actually much darker. And then he gave it to his wife to punch it up and she added all the comedy into it. And it's like some of the best lines in the movie are hilarious. You've got like, we as the audience get to see that the Steve-O guy he's driving in the van with the other guy and his face is all beat up. You know, he's the night before, or he had gotten really beat up by somebody, and he's not a super smart guy. And the other guy isn't either, his friend. And Armie Hammer meets them for the first time. And he's talking with the bosses, you know, he's talking with Cillian Murphy and his buddy Frank. And, you know, you can tell that the three of them are pretty serious people and they're here for a gun deal, you know? And he looks back at the other two and in the previous scene where Armie Hammer wasn't there, we as the audience get to see that he's requesting some makeup so that he can cover up his eye so that he's not distracting and doesn't become an issue kind of thing. That's a stupid thing for that character to do, but at least it's understandable because we are watching that scene play out. And, you know, they dab a bunch of this crap on his face. And then Armie Hammer just gets to watch as this guy with a bunch of makeup on his face and is picking at it, and the other guy's poking the bruise on his face. And that's his introduction to those two characters. And he looks over at Cillian Murphy and he just says, okay. And he says, let's get this thing started. And he glances over at them and he says, the fag and the moron were a really interesting choice for your backup muscle, but okay. You know, I mean, hey, when you've seen the scene that precedes it, it actually kind of makes a certain amount of sense. But from his point of view, that's a hilarious take on what he just saw. You know, but anyway, I also think personally, I mean, even though I like Steve-O's character, I think he's the biggest idiot of the entire group. He's the one that causes all the death and gunplay and destruction and chaos. I mean, we later learned that some chaos would have erupted anyway, but the whole deal falls apart because he's a moron and he feels entitled to sex from a woman who he beat the night before and then got beat as a result of, and this whole, you know, drama played out, and all he had to do was be apologetic and it probably would have all gone away, but he's a freaking moron. So for, you know, 60 minutes of the movie, the last 60 minutes, that's all big giant gunfight. He, despite all of his idiocy, is staying alive. All these people are getting shot over and over and over, and he is staying alive like a cockroach the whole time. And personally, I feel horrible for Jack Rayner's character because his cousin is the one who that guy abused, you know, and they're trying to kill each other this whole movie and they can't do it. At the end of the movie, when that van, you know, again, we're in the spoiler section, rolls over his head. I mean, it's like one of the most satisfying moments ever. It's not only is it, you know, satisfying in a grotesque sort of way, it's hilarious that that's how he met his end. Like, this guy would not die, you know, and it was just so satisfyingly awesome. I can't help but laugh at that scene.
Yeah, I don't know. For me personally, the that's one of the things that troubled me the most is the way the deal falls apart. It just doesn't work for me at all. But I just went along with it after that. It's like, so over this, like, that's the reason why the deal's not going to go right. Like, it's not because the gun were the wrong ones or like other things or like pride or something that's would actually make a lot more sense than like, oh, yesterday, just this guy just happened to like mess with my sister. Like, it's such a convoluted coincidence that of all the women that he could have been involved with the night before, it was like his sister. But I don't know, I guess maybe they're like, they go around the same circles, the same clubs, so maybe, well, that's somewhat believable.
They don't portray that particular aspect as a common thing. I mean, like, everybody else is surprised, including those two characters. I mean, that's the only thing in the movie that's a shock, is the fact that this gun deal is about to go down, and two of the lowest minions on either side of the deal happen to have gotten in a fight the night before.
Yeah, no, the whole thing is very strange. What was the thing towards the end? I remember who, I think Cillian Murphy said to Brie Larson something about like the whole thing was kind of like a setup or something, like the something she, they hired the shooters or something. What was the, okay, like, there was some sort of like resolution, like, not resolution, but like a revelation that I kind of didn't totally get.
So you've got two basic sides. You've got the Irish people, you've got Cillian Murphy and his whole crew, and you've got the people selling the guns, which is of course the guy Frank and the black guy Martin, right? Now, I'm sorry, not Frank. Frank is Vernon. Thank you, Vernon. Charlton Copley's character. So you've got those. Each side has two guys basically that are the head honchos for their side. Then you've got the two people who set up the deal. You've got Brie Larson and Armie Hammer, who are more or less siding with their groups, more or less. But they're kind of, you know, they make a very good point at the beginning of the movie to state that they're more or less in it for themselves. They're just kind of trying to survive. But you've basically got two sides to the conflict the entire time. But about halfway through, two random guys with rifles start shooting at them and ambush everybody. At the end of the movie, the part you're talking about is basically Brie Larson telling him that Brie Larson and the guy Martin, the guy who got shot in the head, the two of them set up the double cross and the ambush in order to take all the money and get away with it.
The two of
Brie Larson and the black
Brie guy. Larson and Cillian Murphy were the one who plotted to basically have the whole thing fall apart. And
No. Brie Larson and Martin, the black guy.
Oh, the black guy? Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Got it. And when did they discuss it at any point? Because I thought the whole revelation thing was with Cillian Murphy towards the end.
Well, Cillian Murphy discovers it, but...
I see. But he still, I guess, but what she did wasn't against him, his interest?
Yeah, sure it was. I mean, she probably was going to more or less either have him killed or take everything away from him, you know, or one way or the other. But, I mean, the two of them have a real flirtatious,
yeah,
like thing throughout the whole movie. And more or less, I would say that of all the people involved, Cillian Murphy seems to be the most genuine out of all of them. I mean, he's also obviously someone with criminal ties who's planning to take a bunch of assault rifles to Ireland or something like that.
That was also weird. The fact that like the whole, when I read the IMDb, it was like, this was in Boston? Based on all the accents, I thought it was like in the UK or something.
Well, it's a bunch of Irish guys. How is he going
to get the guns to Ireland? Like, I guess on a boat or something.
Yeah. I mean, he's just planning to ship them over there. But, you know, obviously it's easier to get guns in America than it is in the UK.
Yeah, maybe. I guess so.
I would think definitely.
Well, I mean, especially in the late 70s with the conflict between the Irish and the British and so on and so forth.
Oh, I see. Yeah, because you couldn't get in the UK.
Right. Yeah. Cillian Murphy and his crew are all, I presume, IRA. And yeah.
Well, I think, I don't know for sure. I think Frank and Cillian Murphy definitely. And yeah. I think that Frank has connections in his sister obviously lives in America in Boston with Steve-O.
Yeah.
and Steve-O's friend is just his friend.
Yeah. But to this day, the IRA is considered to be a terrorist organization. So
yeah.
You go back to the late 70s, it's, you can understand how it could be hard for them to get guns.
Yeah. I mean, so the idea is that they're having the deal there to buy a bunch of guns and he's going to take them back to Ireland. And, then the Americans that are, Martin's American, obviously Charlton Copley's South African, but still they're living there in America. They, you know, they're selling the guns, but the idea is that Martin is as frustrated as you'd imagine anybody would be to be partners with such a ridiculous guy that what's that guy's name again? What's his character's name? Vernon. What? Sorry, Vern.
Yeah. Vernon. Vernon.
Yeah, he's such a difficult person to deal with, you know, that he's planning to double cross him with Brie Larson. And so that's where all that stuff comes into play.
I did find it interesting that in the trivia it said, apparently the role of Vernon was supposed to be Luke Evans, and he ended up dropping out because he was scheduling conflicts with Beauty and the Beast. And that's when Copley got cast. And then also apparently Olivia Wilde was supposed to be Brie Larson's role.
I can see her doing a good job in this too.
Yeah, it would have been like probably like break even. It wouldn't have made it better or worse.
I like Olivia Wilde as an actress. She's pretty good.
Yeah, I liked her in House. I mean, she was fine. Yeah. I don't think she's amazing. She's just like, yeah. Yeah.
But, Drop Dead Gorgeous.
Yeah. Exactly. Like, she's very impressive.
She's exotic.
And she, exactly, yeah. Like something like that. So maybe, like, I don't know. Maybe that would have brought something. But,
also an awful human being, but, you know.
Yeah.
Terrible politics, baby.
Well, I guess we're also works.
No, she's an awful human being.
Well, we can exchange stories later.
Okay. All right. It kind of works out, too, that Armie Hammer has the whole controversy and, like, falling out of grace, like, watching this movie. It's like, yeah, though I think, but more than anything, Cillian Murphy is like just coming off of like watching Oppenheimer is like, oh, this is nice. I had to get to see him act again after he acted his heart out in that movie.
So, yeah. No, I mean, Cillian Murphy, I think, has been one of the most underrated actors in the world for about 20 years now. I mean, even in movies that... you know, you might not like Sunshine. I mean, he's still a hell of an actor in that movie.
Awesome. No, I like him. He's probably one of the better things in that movie.
Right. I mean, 28 Days Later. He's
Batman Begins, The Dark Knight.
Yeah, no, yeah. He's great. I'm glad he got his Oppenheimer moment. I wonder if he might get an Oscar for it.
I am rooting for him, and I'm rooting for Robert Downey Jr. I think that, I feel like Cillian Murphy with Oppenheimer might be having like a Gary Oldman moment with Darkest Hour, in that, you know, film people have known that these guys have been around for a long time and how good they are. But the general public, you know, like, you know, well, they're not, you know, Brad Pitt or Robert Downey Jr. or anything like that. You know, they kind of fly under the radar, and suddenly they do get that title role in this movie, and they get to really showcase what they can do, and suddenly, you know, they're vaulted to public attention. I could really see Cillian Murphy in that kind of Gary Oldman level right now in terms of public attention.
Not that I think he would necessarily get more roles or anything. I think he's pretty much doing what he wants to do. Like, he has the career that he wants to have, but it is kind of cool that, like, after doing all these small parts and Nolan films, like, he basically called him up one day and said, like, okay, so this next one, you're it. Like,
yeah,
you take center stage. There's no, like, you know. And funny enough, like, I don't know why, but it's like a funny story, but like, he, Matt Damon, like, he said, Christopher Nolan called him back, for Interstellar. And he said, like, Matt, how there's no small roles, only small actors. Like, yeah, this is a small role. but I guess he got him back because he gave him a slightly bigger role in Oppenheimer. So, you know, it's worthwhile to do small jobs for Christopher Nolan. He doesn't forget you.
There's a story going around that he actually apologized to Florence Pugh for Oppenheimer. You know, like, he was just saying to her how, you know, like, you know, this is like this is a really small part. You know, and, you know, you're kind of blowing up right now, and, you know, and apparently Florence Pugh said, I don't care if I am just a background actress, like, you know, serving coffee to somebody, you know, I'm game.
Yeah. Yeah, she was a lot more than that.
Yeah, she was pretty important, but we're digressing.
But yeah, but I think that kind of leads back into this movies. I do feel like that when actors do take these ensemble movies, and like when there's no ego, when they're like, just let me, like, you know, do like, you know, whatever is interesting, even if it's a small part. Actually, I just saw like the second season of Good Omens, and they have John Hamm as Gabriel.
Oh, that's interesting.
Archangel, but he's got like memory loss the entire season, so he doesn't know who he is. So he's like behaving really oddly the whole show, like a non-human, but doesn't know he's an angel. But it's like, it's kind of like a small part in the small show, and in the same way that, of course, David Tennant and what's his face, Michael Sheen.
Yes.
Yeah. That's his name. Yeah. I mean, they're two of the biggest actors in the UK, basically. And the fact that they're doing the show, mostly because it's a Neil Gaiman thing, and, you know, it's a great part, great parts for them. But yeah, so I like that when, and similar thing with John Hamm with Maverick, like Top Gun Maverick, is like the people say, like, I don't care if I have a small role. I mean, it's a sequel to Top Gun with Tom Cruise. I'm fucking there. Like, I'm going to do it.
I saw an interview with him talking about how he was like really excited to do the movie.
Yeah. It's like, I like the, I think there's more and more of that. If there's one thing I will say about the state of cinema is that, there's more and more of that where like the whole thing of like small roles in movies really enriches the movie because otherwise, if it's just like all egos, it's like I'm only going to do leading roles, then I think you lose out on a lot of like really good parts that, you know, would have benefited from having someone with some charisma or like some, you know, good baggage from the rest of their work. So I'm glad that's happening.
Not to retread on our last episode, but, you know, Tom Cruise in Tropic Thunder.
Yeah, like Tropic Thunder was a big one, for sure. Like that was all like about smaller parts to some degree, or people doing things that they don't usually do. Funny enough, like Robert Downey Jr.'s kind of similar thing. What he did there is he did an Oppenheimer, like two things that he doesn't often do lately is like comedies or serious movies. So,
yeah.
Yeah. No, I think it's the strength of this movie. Also, the guy, Harry, like Jack Raynor. Yeah. Speaking of Florence Pugh, or whatever the last name. You know, he was, I was like, his face looks familiar, but he had the long hair and I couldn't recognize him.
Sing Street.
He was in Sing Street. That's one thing. Who was he there? Because that's
the older brother.
Yeah, but even more so, I remember it from Midsommar, the
oh. Yeah, I didn't see that.
The one. Horror movie, with Florence Pugh and Ari Aster. Yeah, like that's he played her boyfriend basically. It's like essentially like a co-lead in that movie. It's a good movie, but that's my main takeaway is that like yes, like if you do good on casting, which they did here, even with so dialogue and so direction, it held up. Like it didn't get too boring, it didn't get too like monotonous, like the whole one location thing. It was no 12 Angry Men of course, but as far as like right. That's the main thing I would say is like, and you if you have one location kind of movie, and obviously another example with Tarantino is Hateful Eight, which apparently was one of the inspirations for this movie too because it came the year before. But or at least in the style as they were making it. But it's you definitely see the difference in quality. Like when someone like a Tarantino or Sidney Lumet does like a chamber drama, it goes places. Like it's a journey. Like it's got ups and downs, like highs and lows, dramatic ones. Not just like now we have guns blowing, now we don't. Now we have guns blowing again, and now we don't. That's not high and low. Like the high and low in a Tarantino movie or a Sidney Lumet, and there's some other examples I'm sure we can come up with, are, you know, it's drama, it's story, and it's just there's less of that here, but I get it. This is like a fun shoot 'em up movie, and it's got like a shtick, and it's enjoyable. Like if you want to see something like that, oh, I wonder how they pulled it off and if it worked well. But I agree. The main takeaway for me, aside from the cast, is the fact that I'm not sure how rewatchable this movie is. I guess for the cast, yeah, maybe.
Well, just throwing it out there, because I mean, I agree with you. It's not Reservoir Dogs, and while it's an entirely, it's a slightly more difficult thing to compare it to, because 12 Angry Men is literally Talking Heads. It's definitely no 12 Angry Men either. I mean, like an interesting movie that I think is a very good comparison to it is there's this movie Unknown. It was like, what year did this come out? Let's see. 2006. So like a decade earlier. I mean, I rented this movie from Blockbuster because of its cast. You know, I mean, it's like Jim Caviezel, Greg Kinnear, Joey Pants, you know, Bridget Monaghan, Barry Pepper. I mean, it's just got all these big names that I really liked. Peter Stormare's in it. I watched this movie like one time, and it's about a bunch of guys waking up in a warehouse, and then they slowly like getting into altercations and stuff like that because nobody can remember what the heck happened or how they all got there. But I mean, it's easily like one of the most forgettable movies. In fact, I probably only remembered it because of the similarities to this movie, being that the entire thing takes place in one location and it has a big ensemble cast and so on and so forth. But like, you know, all I'm saying is that in a spectrum of movies that take place in one location, I mean, I would hardly put this on the opposite end of Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah, I can see that. It's got worse reviews. Mm-hmm. Unknown, although the audience rating is the same as Free Fire, which is maybe that makes some sort of point. It's like I said, so like maybe there's like certain qualities to this movie. Like I said, it doesn't get too boring. It does have like its way about the violence, and the cast is very solid. That maybe like that's why critics said like, oh, there's some value here. But for audiences, like maybe there wasn't as much value in Unknown, but for audiences, if you're just coming in and you just want to see a shoot 'em up movie, it does the job. Like it basically, you know, what else can you ask for? You can, I think we brought this up on Running Scared. Like not every movie could be, like we said, directed by Nolan, Denis, or Tarantino. You gotta have like some movies that are going to be less than, you know, because let's face it, there's only, you know, there's always like some number of superstars at any one era of of movie making.
That's an interesting comparison to, but I was just going to say, like, to answer your question, you know, where you were like, what else could you ask for? I mean, the reason I give it an 8, even though I love this movie, is that while I love it, like I said, it's not, I don't see it as super ambitious. The ending of Reservoir Dogs has this, I think, very meaningful, you know, climax. It has a very meaningful ending to it. There's other movies. I don't think that The Hateful Eight is as good of a movie as Reservoir Dogs, but the ending of The Hateful Eight has something really meaningful to say.
How well it can, or Reservoir Dogs?
Both. I'm saying. Oh, okay. I'm saying that
because you started with one and finished with the other side.
Well, what I'm saying is that the Hateful Eight isn't as good as Reservoir Dogs. But
they both had
have a pretty meaningful ending. This one, I'm not saying it's void of meaning. It just doesn't have that punch. You know, I mean, you while we're talking about, let's just go over all of them. The 12 Angry Men has a catharsis to it. You know, you get to the end of that movie and you're like, whoa, it's like, you know, I don't know. This might be a bit of an exaggeration, but I wouldn't argue with somebody if they said that movie was like life-changing or something. You know, it's a great movie. You know, this movie is, Free Fire is very, very good. I don't think that the script had anything in it that you get to the end and you're just like, you know, standing ovation kind of thing. It's just, and so it, to me, it's like, what else could you want? I mean, you know, maybe a little bit more meat. That's about all I would want. I think it's a wonderfully put together movie that intended to set up characters, give you realistic characters, and give you a reason why they're going to have a real time 60 minute shootout, you know, or whatever the actual length of the shootout portion is. It's about 60 minutes probably, you know, but you get this story that just unfolds in real time and they're all just shooting at each other and trying to figure out what the heck is going on and trying to survive. And for that being its goal, it accomplished it pretty well. It just doesn't have some awesome punch at the end that like makes you go, I got to tell everybody I know about this movie.
It lacks a certain je ne sais quoi.
Yeah, and I don't even think it's necessarily substance that's missing it. It's just like the better ones of these types of movies, definitely, whether it's like a big twist in the end or whether it's some sort of like, yeah, revelation or yeah, like I said, catharsis, like it doesn't necessarily have to say anything, but it there's definitely like I feel like Reservoir Dogs for sure wasn't necessarily a substance heavy movie, for that matter, like Pulp Fiction as well. And this might be a subject of conversation at some point, because I know we've had this discussion about, like, I just watched this documentary about Kubrick, like it's a Kubrick by Kubrick, with like, it's like an hour of like basically snippets of interviews that he did with this French journalist, and he says, they get very deep into some of his movies, and he says, like, yeah, he mentioned about his first movie, how it was like overly amateurish, but like strive to be too poetic and stuff, but it was a good exercise for him because it was the right idea, just not done correctly, and he kind of like took that with him to the rest of his movies, only more humbly, like more like, don't play up the meaning or what you're trying to convey, but still have it be there, like just in a lesser amount, because it's worthwhile, like for a movie to be very entertaining, very fun, and if you want to dig deep, there'll be something there for you to dig deep and kind of get meaning out of, but at the same time, I think that like there's movies like Tarantino. I think Tarantino and maybe Sergio Leone, and that kind of makes sense because like he's kind of like his stepchild. But they're like the two possibly greatest directors that mostly made movies that had no substance. Like they're not trying to say anything. They're not trying to like, you know, explore the human condition. They're just out to make great entertainment and have a cathartic story with a great resolution and a few twists and turns, and it's exciting. And the only time that like Sergio Leone tried to have any substance was in DocuSucker, and it's by far not his best movie. So you just see it, that just doesn't work for him. What works for him is to just be this exciting, you know, really fun, really cathartic filmmaker that's just like out to take you on a ride, like a good roller coaster ride, not like the Marvel ones that Scorsese compared to roller coasters.
Oh my god!
You know, but the point is that like that I think it's an interesting tension. The movies that are just out to like be great entertainment and have some catharsis as a story, because every story ending properly is satisfying. And then there's movies that just dig very deep, like 12 Angry Men and like other ones. So I think it's, there's like, I think we've mentioned before, there's a room for both, and if they're done properly. And this is definitely in the category of the just fun entertainment. But yeah, maybe it was just lacking something, like a slightly bigger punch. I don't know what was supposed to be the punch there, really, but I guess it was the whole revelation that she set him up or something.
No, I don't know. For me, when I try to dig into this movie, I think there's something very fascinating about the way that Cillian Murphy and Armie Hammer play off of each other, because they're on opposite ends of this conflict. But Armie Hammer doesn't take anything personally because he's a professional. Him and Brie Larson are the most professional people there. You can really see it in the way that they are trying to manage the situation and prevent it from getting out of hand. Because that's kind of their part in this whole thing. In the one of the earlier scenes when Brie Larson is talking to Cillian Murphy in the car, he's describing his relationship. It's kind of the early character development stuff. He's saying that his business partnership with Frank is that Frank is there to do the business, or his job is to make the deal, and Cillian Murphy's job is to make sure that Frank doesn't get in his own way, doesn't ruin it himself, kind of thing, because Frank's a bit of a hothead, you know. And then you can clearly see that on the opposite side of it, that Vern is just a train wreck of a person to deal with. But what I'm getting at here is that throughout the movie, throughout the conflict, I mean, you know, you've got the two personalities that have to come to a conflict, which is Frank and Vern. And the two of them go so far out of their way to try and get to that stupid phone that's up in that office. And they kill each other, basically, in the process of doing so. And it's some of the more violent stuff in the movie, actually, what they do to each other up in that office. By the end of it, every single person is dead. I mean, the last four people alive that you know of that are alive is Cillian Murphy, Army Hammer, and then the two guys that started the whole thing, the two, you know, muscle guys, you know, Jack Rayner and the Steve-O character, you know, and they're the two that have the biggest beef with each other because Steve-O put that guy's sister in the hospital, you know, or cousin or sister, whoever the hell it was. You know, like, so their conflict with each other gets extremely violent, as I stated before, with the van and everything. They both end up basically dead. And then it's all that's left is Army Hammer and Cillian Murphy. And at the end of this thing, the sprinklers come on or something stupid like that, which kind of in a way emotionally seems to sort of wash away some of what's just happened. And Army Hammer, despite being on the other side of things, is so professional that he can walk over and try to help Cillian Murphy up. He gives him his arm to, you know, helps him to kind of get to his feet a bit. And even though Cillian Murphy's kind of, you know, kind of resisting a bit, he's like, come on, just like, stop. Like, let's go get a drink. Let's just put all this behind us, kind of thing. And there's something about how the two of them, it seems like it's going to have this kind of nice happy ending because they can be, they're the two most level-headed people there probably. And then Brie Larson guns them down and takes the money, you know? And it's just, I don't know. There's something about that. I'd have to really think about it if I was going to try to verbalize it as a, you know, a theme or something like that. Cause I don't know if that's really what it is, but I just find there's something rewarding about what's being said there, just kind of like about the various personalities, how they react in this situation and how there was almost something beautiful there, you know, something very, I don't know what the right word would be to describe that, but wholesome, maybe. I don't know. That's probably not the right word.
Well,
but
I think as you were explaining it, I think I might have gotten
go for it, please.
Gotten something from please. That because I think that because I was wondering about like that, like why just one girl, and then you kind of realize because she's the one who gets away, and also they let her
get away. She doesn't get away. I mean, she's Steve Buscemi at the end of Reservoir Dogs. She's the one running away with the money when the cops show up.
Yeah, sorry. Yeah, the movie ends with her getting caught. Yes. It's the whole thing of like, yeah, for sure. But I'm just saying she gets
she
away.
Survives.
From getting, she survives. Yeah, she doesn't get killed.
She gets to that point, yeah.
And the reason why, like, when you think about this movie, it's like it's a bunch of guys with guns and a girl, which, you know, oftentimes would be at a disadvantage, you know, physically and whatnot, even though with guns, it's kind of an equalizer if you're good with guns. But I think it's a strategy because if you're a woman, you know, that can play into your favor in a crisis situation where men would be more merciful towards you.
They certainly are in the
because of your gender. So, and that's why the whole thing about her saying that, like, I'm in it for myself.
Yeah.
Is that, like, you know, why would this person, like, get into crime? That's the other thing with this movie. I was like, that would have been an interesting movie if you want to talk about, like, they spend this whole time in the warehouse. Like, if they had gotten into, like, and this is just a whole other movie, but if they had gotten to kind of, like, while they're doing the shootout, they talk to each other and they kind of, like, explore how they got to where they got, like, as far as, like, getting into the life of crime. Because it feels like
Tarantino-esque flashbacks.
Maybe something like that. Not necessarily flashbacks, but it could be like one or two lines that they speak to each other about explaining, like, how they, you know, jumped from one thing to the next and somehow, like, got it mixed up in this thing. And now they're stuck in this, like, life and death situation. And is it worth, was it all worth it and all that? But in any case, but yeah, in her specific case, it's sort of like it was like an advantage for her. And that's why she got out, except for the cops showing up. But like, that's why she was the only woman. That's why that was her whole plan. Like, she kind of knew that because she's a woman, they would think she's the weakest, and they wouldn't suspect her to be the one that's, like, to blame for all this. And so it's kind of like the perfect plan. Maybe that's what it's going for, you know.
Maybe on some level, yeah. I mean, I don't know. She's definitely... It's very clear that she's treated differently in a very realistic way throughout the movie. I mean, Cillian Murphy, she's more or less showing up to the deal on his side of the exchange. So it makes sense that she runs off to their side when the shooting starts. But, like, you can see the way that Vern reacts. He spends the first 5 minutes of the shootout, like, yelling at Armie Hammer, going, why is she over there? Why is she talking to him? Like, all these ridiculous things that you should not be discussing or concerned about in a shootout. But, you know, he's trying to decide if she's an enemy or not, you know? And there's all those moments where she yells out to everybody, I'm running over here. Nobody shoot at me, you know, kind of moment. And then Jack Raynor shoots her in the leg or something, you know? But yeah, I mean, there's that whole part where Cillian Murphy goes way out of his way to try and cover her, to let her get to the door and get away. And he even yells to the other side, hey, everyone stop shooting and let, what was her name? Started with a J.
Justine.
He's like, let Justine get out of here. And then, and both sides go, yeah, okay. Nobody shoot. Go ahead. Let her go. You know, kind of thing. I mean, there's definitely some of that playing out, what you're describing.
Yeah. I mean, generally, it's my last takeaway for this movie, I guess, is that I didn't really understand. It's like, why did this have to go as long as it did? Like, once they started shooting, exactly, because it was like, we needed to have a movie, so it needed to go on for like 90 minutes. But it's like, once the shooting happens and they disperse to your different corners, why not just communicate, you know, by shouting and sort it all out? Because obviously he still wants the guns. Just talk. Like, I mean, they're within shouting distance. Why not just like...
Well, think about what started it, though. So you have two guys on your crew. And, in you know, I'm only speaking from this academically, not from experience. But I would assume when you're living a life of crime, it's pretty important to be loyal to the people on your side. You know, it's and everything, but you know, you got two different sides of people facing each other, and one of them wants to kill somebody on the other side for very, very justifiable reasons. And all that both parties want to do is smooth it over in some way, shape, or form. And when they try to do that, the dumbass who caused this problem says what he says about the guy's sister or cousin or whatever.
Cousin. It was a cousin. Yeah.
Cousin, thank you for finally straightening that out. Yeah. I mean, like, this guy is a fucking idiot. Okay. I mean, the girl, you know, didn't give him you know, a blowjob, and he took a bottle and hit her over the head with it. You know, he broke a bottle, a glass bottle over her head because she refused to give him oral sex. And then when the guy beat the crap out of him, the next day they see each other. They almost get into a fight again, or they do get into a fight again. The guy's trying to kill him. This whole thing is getting so tense that they're about to, you know, murder each other. And he apologizes. They're about to smooth it out. And he says something like, "It's a good thing your cousin didn't blow me, because I would have," he says something like that, "they would have found teeth in her fecal matter," or something. I mean, like, he says something so horribly disrespectful that it's like, I am totally on Jack Rayner's side when he goes and gets his gun and tries to kill him. You know, I mean, so what are you going to do if you're Army Hammer and you're, you know, Vern, or I mean, sorry, not if you're the Irish guys, if you're Killian Murphy and Frank, and you want to take these guns and go, I mean, short of taking this guy, Steve-O, and offering him up to get murdered, what are you going to do? I mean, Frank seems like the kind of guy who might actually do that, except that Steve-O is his brother-in-law. So his sister would probably never speak to him again.
If it's like a brother-in-law, I can see that connection. I didn't even remember that.
And then Killian Murphy is too nice of a guy. He's too much of a stand-up guy to just let this guy get murdered, you know, despite the fact that he deserves it. You know?
Although he seems like the most professional one and the one that wanted to just, like, be done.
Well, that's why he beat the crap out of them in front of them and said, look, he's been disciplined. He's going to apologize. You know, he tried his best. So it's like, how do you resolve that situation? You know, once the first shot is fired, what are you going to do? You know?
Yeah, it's weird. It's tough. But I will say, as you were saying that, I was kind of thinking like, there's a little bit of a Time to Kill vibe here.
Yeah.
You know, the circumstances, like, you know, if somebody like abuses your family member, you just want to just kill them. I mean, very understandable, especially if they're already criminals. Yeah. But at the same time, if they're like hired guns, basically, to some degree, and they're not the head honchos of this deal, like, you would think that the head honchos will just say, like, you and you, both of you, just fuck off and sort it out outside or something.
It wouldn't be the worst thing for them to have done,
probably. Yeah, yeah. But once, I guess, the shooting started. But I'm just saying, a lot of these things are just, like, very thin threads where, like, you kind of have to, like, fine, okay, I guess that's a reason to have a 60-minute shootout over, like, an argument between the two henchmen. I mean, it's just a bit, it's a very thin, you know, plot line. That's all I'm saying, but it's fine. It's passable.
It's funny. As we were talking about this, I just remembered something. You were asking me about the funny moments of this movie, and Sam Riley, the Steve-O character, he has a kind of subtle joke that is so funny, because in that scene where the tensions have gotten so high, and they're the other guys, Army Hammer, and they're holding, they're almost physically holding Jack Rayner back, you know, and he's got a tire iron in his hand and they're holding him back. And Frank grabs Steve-O and pushes him up against the van. You remember, they take him away a little bit and he presses him against the van with his forearm on his throat. And he's just like saying all these disrespectful things to him. And he's just like, "You're ruining this deal and I'm going to kill you," and all these stuff like that. And like, this guy Steve-O is so stupid. In this moment, he's saying all the worst things you could possibly say, because he's not being apologetic at all. He's denying everything, you know, whatever. And Killian Murphy comes up to him and he's like, "What the hell happened?" And he's like, "Is this guy is saying all these things about you?" While Frank has him you know, holding him up against the fan in a violent manner, he says to Killian Murphy, "It's all lies. It's all lies. I swear on my wife's life," which is Frank's sister. You know, it's the worst thing you could possibly say.
I see. You know, I think the most amusing thing that I heard in the whole movie was in the first scene in the truck when he told them, like, that he's got like a headache or something.
Yeah.
And he said, like, "Do you have something for a headache?" And says, like, "I have crack."
Yeah. He said, "I have smack or something."
Smack or something. I don't know what it was, but it says, like, Boy, that would be like taking a sledgehammer to you know, to try and like you know, hit a nail or something. Like, it's just like such an overkill to take like heavy drugs just for a headache. Anyways, I don't know, but yeah, I don't know why the humor like just didn't really land with me. It could have been just the circumstances in which I watched a movie. But one last thing I was gonna say is that, like, I didn't connect this earlier, but Armie Hammer gave me a little bit of John Hamm vibes in this movie too. I felt like his presence, like the whole deep voice, tall American man. I don't know. I felt like it's like, you know, for one thing, John Hamm would have been amazing in that role.
Oh man, he would have. Yeah,
and probably would be even better than what he did in Baby Driver.
It's funny, when you were making your final point about Brie Larson being, I guess, about the story having some relevance to her being the only woman there, it just reminded me that I was, as I was looking for that information and I was watching the little behind the scenes thing, there was a really funny moment where they were, the behind the scenes stuff was, you know, interviewing her and talking to her about stuff. And she was just saying how she said, in general, I'm used to doing movies where there's a lot more men than women or something like that. I'm not sure exactly how she wrote it. She said it, I mean, but she said, this is a movie where it's like a lot of testosterone. It's like a lot of guys here on set. And I'm like the only woman. And I think there's probably a moment where somebody asked her how that affects things or something like that. I don't remember exactly how they set up the moment, but she says, something I learned on this set is that when you get this many men around, any surface, any wall, any window, anything, any box, anything offset, it doesn't matter what it is, if they find a place where they can draw a penis on the wall, they will. And I just laughed so hard. I'm just thinking, I'm trying to picture Cillian Murphy and all these guys, just like, you know, Armie Hammer and all these people, like, this dust on the penis.
Maybe they were just trolling her the entire time.
Yeah, I don't know. But it was such a funny moment to think about.